Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesay from the History of the Second World War podcast. Join me on a journey through the most destructive conflict in human history, a journey that will take us not just through the famous campaigns and cataclysmic battles, but also to the lesser well-known corners of the war that touched millions all over the world, as we try and answer not just the questions of what and where, but how and why. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grey History, Episode 55, Civil War in the Vendée. In the last two episodes, we examined the triumphs and tragedies of the Revolutionary War in the East. Despite stunning success in the final months of 1792, the French armies were in retreat just months later. The Austrians had stormed back into Belgium, the Prussians had retaken the Rhineland, and the Dutch campaign was almost over as soon as it had begun. These developments were worthy of the words crisis, disaster, and catastrophe. But, unexpectedly, it was the actions of the French army which proved the most alarming. Dumouriez's betrayal and his attempted coup d'etat caused even greater panic and dismay. Who could be trusted in the Republic's hour of need when the so-called saviour of the Republic was himself a treasonous villain? Unfortunately for the revolutionaries, such existential threats were not confined to the East. In March 1793, recruitment riots broke out all over France. And in one region in particular, these riots became something far more sinister. We have finally reached the infamous civil wars of the French Revolution, and the events in the Vendée remain deeply polarizing and contested to this day. So, why did the Vendée break out in rebellion? Why did the civil war commence here when it did? And what was it about the Vendée that permitted not only a bitter and bloody struggle, but also continued unrest for the next two decades? These are just some of the questions that we will explore as we introduce a subject that's so controversial that some historians consider these events to equate to a genocide against French Catholics. But before we get into it, a quick reminder that I need your help. Grey History takes a tremendous amount of time and effort to produce. Episodes can be in excess of 10,000 words each, and they can take me almost 50 hours to produce. Unfortunately, there is no big podcast studio helping to keep Grey History on the air. Nor is there some long list of would-be advertisers. We're a small show sharing detailed history that's nuanced and well-researched. The only way that such a podcast can survive is with the support of its listeners. The amazing members of the Patreon community allow this show to continue. It's literally what's keeping me fed. So I cannot stress enough that I need your help to keep producing the history podcast that you've come to love. For as little as half a cup of coffee, for as little as $2 an episode, you can ensure that there's more Grey History waiting for you tomorrow. And in fact, with bonus episodes, episode extras, and a whole bunch of other perks, there's more Grey History waiting for you right now. Indeed, episode 56, Fasting and Furious, is already available now for those patrons with early access. So please, help promote history that isn't black and white, and indulge in even more Grey History. Just Google Grey History Patreon and support the show today. Speaking of help, it's time to introduce the amazing people who have recently joined the Grey History community. A warm welcome to the newest virtuous citizens, Kaya, Torben, Claude, and David. Another warm welcome to the newest true revolutionaries, Andrew, Scott, and Sio. And I hope you enjoy your early access to episode 56, Fasting and Furious. Of course, all revolutions need champions of the people. So a special thank you to Cynthia, George, Tim, Mark, William, Laura, Daniel, Monica, Joel, Susan, and Adam. Finally, a warm welcome to the extra generous Augur, who joins the fabulous Heroes of the Revolution, Brian, Christy, Charles, and Jeff. A reminder that if you want to enjoy more Grey History, and if you want to keep enjoying more Grey History in the future, please come and join all these amazing people in the Patreon community and support the show for as little as half a cup of coffee. Anyway, that's enough from me, so let's get into it. Welcome to Grey History. Episode 55, Civil War in the Vendée. As I've mentioned multiple times, I love board games. I love the strategy, I love the tactics, I love the improbable come-from-behind victory. Thankfully, I know quite a few people that are willing to indulge me in this vice. In particular, my girlfriend and her family love a good games night, accompanied by cheese and wine, just to make sure that the taste of defeat isn't too bitter. Recently, we dusted off an old classic, Risk. Now, for those of you who didn't have a childhood, Risk is essentially a map of the world, divided up into a few dozen territories. Each turn, you accumulate soldiers based on how many territories you own, and the aim of the game is, surprise, surprise, world domination. Now, what's fun about Risk is that everything generally seems to be going okay, until it isn't. In my experience, players are cautious until they're not. Like sharks, once blood is in the water, the frenzy begins. A defeat on your eastern flank may seem manageable, but it's not when everyone else senses weakness and strikes. In a single round, your empire can go from mighty to mutilated. Risk is a great example of Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it will. This all-too-familiar experience of Risk reminds me of the experiences of the French Republic in 1793. Having cast aside the king and the court, the Republican armies had seemed invincible. Unbelievable gains had been made across the frontiers as multiple French assaults secured stunning success. With Belgium, the Rhineland, and Savoy under French occupation, was this not proof of the superiority of free citizen soldiers? Was this not proof that the crusade for universal liberty was destined to succeed? But in March 1793, everything fell apart. A well-orchestrated Austrian counterattack not only crippled the invasion of the Dutch Republic, but it soon reclaimed the Austrian Netherlands as well. Further south, the Prussians' counterattack was equally successful, seizing much of the Rhineland and its major urban centres. Most worryingly for the Republic, the events had exposed the treachery of their most celebrated military commander. General de Maurier had attempted to march on Paris, and it was only the loyalty of his troops which averted a catastrophe. This in and of itself was an existential threat to the juvenile Republic. But by April 1793, it was not the only one. As the Austrians and the Prussians advanced, as the rest of Europe mobilized for war, as de Maurier began to go rogue, a new disaster emerged in the West. A disaster that came to be known as the Civil War in the Vendée. Before we can discuss the uprisings of March 1793, we first need to become familiar with where exactly is the Vendée. For those with Google Maps handy, you can type in Vendée, VENDEE, to see the modern-day department of France. As you'll see immediately, Vendée is a coastal department, roughly halfway up France's western coast. The department begins just south of the Loire River and the large urban centre of Nantes. And it ends about 100 miles north of the major maritime city of Bordeaux. But the Vendean Revolt included many communities that are not incorporated in the modern-day department of Vendée. Instead, the events we'll be discussing occurred across multiple neighbouring departments, and these adjacent regions were at times the focal point of the conflict. So it's important to note that when we're discussing the Vendée, it's really this broader area of Western France that we're discussing. For those curious, I've put a map on social media, Patreon, the website, and in the episode email, which shows the extent of the rebellion and compares it to the modern-day department. The rebellion commenced in the second week of March, 1793. As a nice change of pace for the French Revolution, this unrest was not caused by high bread prices, starving stomachs, or an impending Prussian army. Instead, the catalyst is generally considered to be the French army, or more accurately, the need to create one. In February 1793, the convention had passed a decree which sought to raise hundreds of thousands of soldiers for the army. These troops were desperately needed, as one of the issues limiting Dumouriez in Belgium was a lack of manpower. By early March, recruitment agents were fanning out across the Vendée, and this is when the proverbial hit the fan. For reasons we will discuss later this episode, many areas of the Vendée had become deeply hostile to the revolution. The requirement to now fight and die for the repulsive revolution was the final straw. In what appears to be near simultaneous outbreaks of disorder, several rural communities rose in insurrection. While each village experienced a different set of circumstances, across many of them, the events were characterized by episodes of extreme violence. One witness, a non-constitutional priest supportive of the rebels, described a scene of unimaginable carnage. According to the undoubtedly biased cleric, the people threw off their chains and their silence, and attacked the government officials with an unbelievable fury. The bodies reflected as such. The victims were those connected to the Republican regime in Paris. The insurrectionists, primarily, but not exclusively, members of the rural peasantry, unleashed their anger at local officials. Hundreds of civil servants were slaughtered. Administrators, tax collectors, constitutional clergy, any and all associates of the revolution were fair game. In a sense, what occurred was a miniature reversal of the September massacres 6 months prior. Back then, the enemies of the people were nobles, non-constitutional priests, and other so-called agents of the counter-revolution. The mob had demanded justice, and justice was delivered with a blade. Now, it was local administrators, constitutional priests, and other agents of the revolution which were deemed to be the people's enemies. As such, they shared the same fate. Rebellion had broken out in the Vendée. But it was not yet a civil war. On the 11th of March, the administrators of the Department of the Lower Loire portrayed a calamity to their superiors in Paris. According to the local authorities, everywhere patriots were falling victim to the fury and fanaticism of the rebels. The insurrectionists pillaged, murdered, and burnt everything in their path, and the officials on the ground were powerless to stop the fast-spreading rebellion. Now, this may sound like a catastrophe, but for the deputies in the convention, this was just another day in the office. Initially, the convention failed to ascertain the seriousness of the situation at hand. far away from the disorder, the revolt looked like many others which were occurring across France at this time. Resistance to army recruiters had fueled riots across the nation. Normandy, Brittany, and Burgundy were just some of the other regions which had all seen unrest. From the capital, it wasn't clear that the Vendée was any different. But the Vendée was different, if for no other reason that the convention had no means to suppress the anti-recruitment riots. Whereas in other regions, the government had enough men to quell any unrest, the Republican regime was dangerously undermanned in the Vendée. Many of the revolution's most ardent supporters had already answered the call of the army recruiters, and thus what remained were those with little inclination to support the revolution. Furthermore, it's not like the nation had any troops to spare. All available men were needed on the frontiers, as Austria and Prussia pushed forward with astonishing success, and as Spain and England prepared to commence their own attacks. As such, it took time for the convention to muster enough troops to reassert its authority. By the time it had done so, it was already too late. When the convention sent in the troops, the Republican government found opposing it not some rabble of draft-dodging peasants, but rather the makings of a counter-revolutionary regime. While the Republicans had been assembling a force to suppress the Vendean revolt, the Vendeans themselves had ensured that this conflict would morph from rebellion into outright civil war. As previously mentioned, the backbone of these insurrections were members of the peasantry. But some of those leading these pitchfork-parading pious peasants were other members of the Third Estate. At least initially, instances can be found of peasants, gamekeepers, and even former soldiers in prominent leadership positions. Most entertainingly, there was even a priest who led one band of rebels. I like to think that this was the Knights Templars returning to France in the most unlikeliest of ways, but alas, I know better. However, to digress for just a moment, the Templars' leadership were famously burnt at the stake for heresy in 1314. Now, in an intriguing turn of events, some of these peasant rebels decided to pull down a liberty tree and proceeded to burn a local administrator on a bonfire made of that tree. So, between the warrior priests and the roasting of political opponents, I think the case can be made that the Templars had partially made a return. I know that's a bit of a stretch, but, I mean, come on. Mob executions on Liberty Tree bonfires? Who saw that one coming? Alas, I have well and truly digressed. Despite the flaming success of the initial uprisings, if the revolt was to last, the rebels needed new leadership. Preferably, this meant leadership which possessed two things. Firstly, military experience, and secondly, authority and respect within the local community. For both of these things, the insurrectionists turned to members of the nobility. Intriguingly, historians argue how involved members of the nobility were in the revolt's commencement. We'll get into the details shortly, but many historians claim that former aristocrats had largely stayed out of the initial uprisings. Yet, with insurrection having broken out, and with the Republic's authority fast diminishing to just the large urban centres, some former nobles took the plunge. Furthermore, the more conservative aristocrats were encouraged to join the rebellion once it became clear that the peasants were willing to adopt a pro-royalist and pro-Catholic agenda. As such, the introduction of politically and socially conservative leadership helped to facilitate the transition from a mere peasant revolt to a full-fledged counter-revolutionary movement. And make no mistake, the presence of new leadership was felt immediately. Not only did the nobility start to impose greater discipline and tactics, but they also worked towards the creation of some sort of counter-revolutionary state. What eventually developed was the formation of the Vendean Grand Council. This body started printing its own paper currency and proclaiming decrees and edicts in the name of King Louis XVII. Just in case there be any doubt that the Vendean regime was pro-royalist, the body even put a depiction of Louis XVII on their new paper currency. Unfortunately for young Louis, the son of Louis XVI, paying 50 livres would not get the 8-year-old out of jail in Paris. In addition to the Grand Council, new elections were held for local communities, with committees promptly organising the collection of weapons and supplies. But what I don't want to do is oversell the cohesion of the rebels. Although operating underneath the grandiose title of the Grand Council, as well as the Catholic and Royal Army, what we're really talking about here is essentially independent armies. The spontaneous rebellions across the Vendée slowly consolidated into a handful of forces which more or less just followed their own commanders. Thus, what was really developing here was almost something akin to factional warlords. While all fighting under the same banner, many leaders drew support from specific localities, and they weren't really thrilled at the idea of subordinating themselves to one another in the name of a superior cause. Furthermore, the royalism of the peasants had its limits. The peasantry weren't exactly willing to march on Paris to restore the old regime, and as forces moved further away from their home territories, issues such as desertion and discipline came to the fore. All of these factors would cost the revolt in the future, when they faced a more cohesive and disciplined opponent. But despite the divisions of the rebels, the insurgents continued to have tremendous success. After some brief setbacks, the Vendeans returned to the offensive, rebuffing the troops sent by the convention to suppress the rebellion. By late May 1793, a significant proportion of the Vendée was under their control, with only the largest urban centres remaining steady holdouts. Worryingly for the convention, on the 9th of June, the large town of Saumur fell, another major victory for the royalists. This victory was important in itself, but it was even more consequential given events elsewhere. By June, civil war was no longer contained to the Vendée, with the Federalist revolts breaking out across the country. These revolts were triggered in part by important events in Paris, which we will be discussing in future episodes. For now, what is important to note is that the civil war in the Vendée was fundamentally different compared to those other conflicts, which is why we talk about them separately. So, with civil war now erupting across the nation, this is where we'll leave the Vendean rebels. By the start of June, a large portion of western France had been occupied, and the rebels were threatening to take the important urban centre of Nantes. Worryingly, if the royalists could seize a major port on the Atlantic coast, the British could theoretically land troops to reinforce and resupply the rebellion. Thus, the threat from the west was significant, and it would require a brutal response from Paris.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
The episode extra for this episode is titled Hills, Hedges, and Humble Clerics. In it, we use a contemporary's memoirs to unpack why the topography of the Vendée was so beneficial to the defending insurrectionists. Furthermore, we also use those same memoirs to hear a royalist's perspective on the role of religion in the outbreak of the rebellion. The episode extra is available to all members of the Grey History community. So for the price of just half a cup of coffee, come join the club and enjoy all the perks that come with it. There's half a dozen full-length bonus episodes covering everything from the Corsican Revolution to scientists during the revolutionary era. There's also an ad-free version of the show, so no more mid-episode interruptions like this one. Help support history that embraces detail and ambiguity, and join the Grey History community today. Having discussed the outbreak and initial success of the revolt, I want to turn our attention to why. Why did Western France become the first region to rebel against the Republic? Why was this rebellion so brutal and bloody from the very outset? And why do historians disagree on everything from the revolt's causes to its leadership to its fundamental nature? Why is the question? And now for the answers. What's immediately interesting about the Vendée is that in 1789, there weren't really any clues that this was going to be the home of France's most brutal civil war in the revolutionary era. Nor were there any clues that this would be the region which would rebel prior to any other. If you read the list of grievances drafted immediately before the Estates General commenced, the contents of those documents offer no indication of an impending counter-revolutionary catastrophe. Historian Peter McPhee notes that these grievances were generally less likely to criticise the church when compared to other regions, but that's about it. Indeed, when the revolution broke out promptly in the summer of 1789, the residents of the Vendée offered no meaningful opposition. Instead, the revolution promised to transform the lives of everyday citizens, and, like so many across France, the locals of the Vendée eagerly awaited the fruits of this most wonderful development. Yet, as the revolution wore on, some residents of the Vendée started to discover a very bitter taste in their mouths. From mid-1790 until the outbreak of civil war in March 1793, the revolution's support waned and then all but disappeared in the Vendean countryside. Ultimately, the seeds sown by the revolution were not for social justice or a rejuvenated society, but for a civil war which would see society tear itself to pieces. To understand why this was the case, we have to look at how the revolution fundamentally changed the lives of ordinary people in the rural regions of the Vendée. Having promised the world, rural communities quickly concluded that the revolution had delivered an atlas. Yes, privileges had been abolished, yes, feudalism had been suppressed, but in the Vendée, these victories for the rural Third Estate were smaller than they had been elsewhere. Unlike many other parts of France, many peasants, including better-off peasants, were renters of long-term tenancies. This meant that the abolition of feudal privileges and seigneurial rights had comparatively little impact on the peasantry of the region. Instead, the revolution's reforms benefited the landowners, which in this case were often members of the urban-dwelling bourgeoisie. And this brings us to one of the defining characteristics of the Vendean revolt, the urban-rural divide. If the peasantry hadn't seen the gains of the revolution, the urban bourgeoisie had. As a result of the abolition of privileges and the tithe, landowners were able to make the case that the value of their property had now increased. As such, these landlords used that excuse to justify a hike in rents for their peasant tenants. Furthermore, the nationalisation and sale of church property had also benefited the well-to-do in the towns. Although the government was selling the seized land in a public process, not everyone could buy a slice of heaven. One required money to purchase these properties, something the peasants didn't have in abundance. As such, it was the urban bourgeoisie who profited from the sale of church land. In the district of Cholet, for example, the bourgeois purchased about 56% of the nationalised property. The nobility purchased about half that again, but the peasants only acquired 9%. Thus, pious peasants saw their town-dwelling landlords enrich themselves while their precious church was despoiled. But that wasn't everything. Reforms to the use of common lands also threatened peasant interests, and it was townsfolk who monopolised the benefits of the new positions and offices that came with the revolution and its administrative reforms. Thus, from the standpoint of the countryside, the revolution had done much to benefit the townspeople and their bourgeois landlords in particular. But for them? Well, for them it had done nothing. Sure, the revolution had provided liberty, whatever that meant, but it had done so at an enormous cost. Rents had increased, churches had been desecrated, and now the army wanted recruits. In other regions of France, the discrepancies in the gains of the revolution were not so stark between rural and urban areas. But here, in the Vendée, the peasantry viewed themselves as very clear losers. If only something could be done. So, one key issue explaining why the Vendée rebelled is these tensions between the urban communities and the rural countryside. But these are not the only tensions we need to explore, and some historians would argue that they pale in comparison to what we're about to discuss. And to be fair, most things pale in comparison to what we're about to discuss, because we're about to discuss everyone's favourite dinner table conversation. Climate change. Oh wait, wrong century. Religion. We're about to discuss religion. You see, if there's one thing that the Vendean rebels are synonymous with, it's Catholic fanaticism. This was a region that was deeply Catholic, and its commitment to Catholicism had a humongous impact on the outbreak and nature of the Civil War. But this was not the only Catholic region of France, nor was it the only region with a high proportion of clergy which refused to swear an oath to the Constitution. So, what made the Vendée different? Why were these sincere Catholics willing to fight for their faith while other devout regions had failed to take up arms? For starters, it's important to appreciate the central role that Catholicism had in the rural Vendée. The countryside was a sparsely populated region with significant distances between large urban centres. The countryside was characterised by high hedges, dense woods, and most importantly, isolated inhabitants. Many individuals lived outside the village, residing on farms or in hamlets. As a result, the church was a fundamental pillar to the local society. With rural peasants generally living quite solitary lifestyles, it was the church which weaved communities together. On Sundays, the church provided not only the spiritual home for the villagers, but also the home for their community more broadly. It was at church that you would see your neighbours, discuss important issues, and catch up on the latest juicy gossip. It was also at church that you would often be counselled on non-religious matters by your local priest. Perhaps one of the few literate members of the village, the influence of the local clergy was enhanced by the fact that they were also responsible for marriages, burials, and baptisms, along with education and charitable activities. The clergy and the church were therefore the heart of the community in the isolated countryside of the Vendée. With many residing outside of the village, it was around the church that communities gathered every Sunday, and not just in a spiritual sense. This helped to explain the unique position of the church in Vendean society. But there were additional factors unique to the region that further enhanced the status and influence of religion. Here, the tithe had been paid directly to local clergy, reducing the misappropriation of church funds and minimizing tensions between the higher and lower clergy. Furthermore, the Vendée had once been a hotbed of Protestantism in the centuries prior to the Revolution. This heresy had been successfully stamped out by dedicated missionaries, but the legacy of those missionaries remained. Having been the focus of intense evangelism, Catholicism was now deeply entrenched in the local society. Compared to other corners of France, a great number of the inhabitants passionately supported the Catholic Church and its traditions. Thus, the scene was set for conflict with the Revolution when the authorities in Paris broke with Rome. Now, it's been a while since we've been in the weeds on the revolutionaries' attempt to reform and subordinate the Catholic Church. As a quick recap, in late 1789, the National Assembly moved to nationalize church property. By seizing church lands and by directly paying the wages of the clergy from the government's budget, the deputies were hoping to use this nationalized property to pay for and service the country's debt. A few months later, the government abolished monasteries and nunneries, arguing that these monastic orders offered little value to society. Since the government was now paying the wages of the clergy, it would hire and fire as it pleased. But up until this point in time, maybe the Revolution and the Catholic Church could still have been friends. There was a lot of tension, to be sure, but the schism had not yet occurred. Critically, in mid-1790, the National Assembly introduced the Civil Constitution of the Clergy. This measure severely curtailed the influence of the Pope, established elections for clerical positions, and reduced the number of parishes and bishoprics. This, along with an oath of allegiance, was a step too far. It took some months for the Pope to condemn the civil constitution, but when he did so, the clergy of France were listening. All over the nation, the clergy were split into two groups. The constitutional priests, also known as juring or patriotic clergy, were those that took the oath and swore loyalty to the revolutionary government. Non-constitutional priests, also known as non-juring or refractory clergy, were those who stayed loyal to Rome and refused the required oath. Initially, there was some tolerance for the dissenters, but as the revolution radicalized in 1791 and 1792, new legislative bodies moved against the refractory clergy. Seen as supporters of the counter-revolution, by the time of the Vendean Rebellion, non-juring priests were liable for imprisonment and deportation. Thus, by March 1793, tensions between the revolution and the church were unprecedented. Between the priest hunts, the prison massacres, the seizure of church property, and the forced administrative reforms, the two sides bitterly opposed the other. The French may not literally have been at war with the Papal States, but the revolution was nonetheless engaged in an existential struggle with the Catholic Church. Refocusing on the Vendée specifically, the various religious reforms of Paris were met with hostility. Given the incredibly devout communities of the Vendée, non-constitutional priests dominated the region. For example, among the 1,058 priests and monks in the Diocese of Nantes, only 159 took the oath to the Constitution. Before accounting for those who would later retract their oath, that was just 15% who conformed with the wishes of Paris. In nearby Anjou, only 44 out of 332 swore the oath, or 13%. Given the small proportion of clerics actually willing to become constitutional clergy, some authorities initially had to tolerate the non-constitutional priests. With time, however, the authorities became stricter, forcibly removing non-juring clergy and replacing them with a sanctioned substitution. But someone had forgotten to ask what the locals would make of all of this. In isolated communities where the priests had built decades of influence and respect, everyday citizens weren't about to take this lying down. Often labelling the new priests as intruders, many villagers proceeded to protest the new clerics in any way they could. At times, this opposition was violent, with the National Guard rolled out to forcibly remove a non-constitutional priest and install his replacement. Other times, this opposition lacked force, but not necessarily humour. Accounts abound of locals finding innovative ways to voice their displeasure. In one community, locals piled into the church prior to the arrival of their new constitutional priest. When the intruder arrived, the congregation promptly ran out the door. In another instance, a group of women shadowed a constitutional priest with brooms, immediately sweeping away traces of his footsteps. When asked why, they informed him that they wanted to remove any evidence of his existence. Just as effective, although a little more subtle, was the sudden surge of lost keys. Clerics were unable to enter their accommodation or their new church, as some clumsy locals had managed to misplace them. How frustrating. Humorous incidents aside, the lack of priests respected by local communities had a very real impact on people's lives. In some regions, the number of weddings dropped by more than 90%, as young couples didn't want their marriage administered by a cleric condemned by the Pope. I do suspect that any delay meant that the would-be newlyweds were living in sin anyway, but that's a digression I have no intention of taking further. In addition to weddings, others refused to allow intruders from providing their services at baptisms or funerals. Of course, mucking with the afterlife was no light matter, especially for the deeply devout. As such, locals would often seek out non-juring clergy to perform these activities. Living in attics, basements, the woods, and even caves, an underground church was fast forming where citizens could receive blessings from their original, untainted priests. While there, you could bet your bottom dollar that it was reinforced that all this misery had been brought on by the revolution. Tensions and resentment between the faithful and the revolution were thus on the rise, and they had further to go. As the revolution radicalized, efforts to detain these rogue clerics increased. In what was essentially priest hunts, authorities would break into homes and barns searching for the renegade clergy, at times upturning furniture and trashing residences as they carried out their pursuit. Of course, all this did was alienate and anger the local inhabitants even further. By March 1793, resistance had been on the rise for months. Chants were heard demanding the return of good priests, and violence increasingly menaced the intruders who were unwanted by pious communities. The warnings from local officials were numerous. In January, one civil servant reported to his department that the greater part of the people were entirely corrupted by fanaticism. Interestingly, he noted that the revolution for them was just a long sequence of injustices, and he assigned the hostility of the people to the work of domestic enemies. In February, a president of a local revolutionary club echoed similar sentiments. He warned that refractory priests and counter-revolutionary nobles ravaged France. To address this menace, he called on the revolution to strike great blows against its enemies. However, no such blow came. The army was stretched thin on the frontiers. The invasion of the Dutch Republic was at hand, and what military resources could be assigned to France were needed in more strategically important towns, ports, and fortifications. Thus, the anger of the people continued to rise, unimpeded. In some villages, locals began to describe the deputies of the National Convention as brigands and scoundrels, while in others, cries for priests, religion, and King Louis XVII became increasingly common. The flames of insurrection were sparked just weeks later, when army recruiters arrived. The peasantry of the Vendée had seen their churches despoiled, their priests hunted, their religion desecrated. Furthermore, they had seen their rents increase, their landlords enriched, and their access to common lands curtailed. The revolution had indeed brought a long sequence of injustices, and now it wanted not only their gold, not only their God, but also their lives. For many inhabitants of the Vendée, this was too far. As one rebel put it, "They have killed our king, driven out our priests, and sold the possessions of our church. Where is the money? They have taken everything. Now they want our bodies. No, they will not have them." Ironically, the revolution would eventually have their bodies, one way or another. Returning to our questions of why, we are now in a position to answer the first question. Why was the Vendée the first region to rebel against the revolution? The answer is the unique set of circumstances that were present. Tensions between urban and rural communities were nowhere near as pronounced in other corners of France, as in some regions, a far greater proportion of the revolution's benefits were enjoyed by the rural Third Estate. Furthermore, it was here, in the deeply devout Vendée, that the revolution's religious reforms had incited tremendous anger. A remote and sparsely populated region, the former Protestant Vendée had been the recipient of intense missionary work in the centuries prior to the revolution. As such, the people were genuine and passionate believers. And when they emerged from their scattered farms and hamlets every Sunday, it was the church that was at the heart of people's lives and communities. It was that heart which had been assaulted by Paris. It was that heart which the revolution had attacked. In addition to this, unlike other deeply Catholic regions, the Vendée was nowhere near the frontier. What this meant is that it lacked numerous soldiers to suppress any riot, and the inhabitants lacked any fears about the immediate threat of a foreign army. This tinderbox was a situation unique to Western France, and when army recruiters provided the spark, boy oh boy, did it go up in a blaze. As I alluded to previously, historians disagree over many aspects of the Vendean Revolt, including its opening stages. So, what are these fault lines between academics, and how do they impact our basic understanding of the situation in the Vendée? Grey History needs your help to keep the show on the air. For the price of just half a cup of coffee, you can do your bit to ensure that there's more Grey History waiting for you tomorrow. With exclusive bonus episodes, episode extras, early access, and of course an interruption-free version of the show, there's tremendous value in doing your bit to keep the podcast on the air. I absolutely love bringing you this podcast, but right now it's not sustainable. I need your help to secure the future of Grey History. So please, if you find Grey History entertaining, if you find it educational, do your bit to ensure that there's more Grey History waiting for you tomorrow. Without your help, there might not be. Just Google Grey History Patreon and join the community today. The first fault line I want to unpack relates to the very nature of the revolt. What was the most important contributing factor to the Civil War? And what kind of rebellion are we even discussing? As it's generally told, religious tensions are portrayed as the key reason for the revolt's instigation. Recruitment for the army may have been the catalyst, but a full-scale insurrection was only possible due to the repressive religious policies of the revolution. Evidence for this perspective can be found in everything from contemporary accounts to the chants of the peasant rebels. After all, did we not just hear from local officials and revolutionaries who explicitly cited the region's fanaticism and the refractory priests they believed to be the cause of the unrest and disturbances? Furthermore, the justifications used by the rebels themselves often focused on religious freedoms. Again and again, the rebels' chants, songs, and manifestos highlighted the importance of the Catholic faith. They demanded the return of their old priests, the expulsion of the intruders, and the restoration of their beloved church. As historian Timothy Tackett states, the central factor of the rebellion was anger and indignation over the revolution's religious policies. Interestingly, in a clever bit of politics, the rebels adopted the same language as the revolutionaries themselves. Seeking to justify their actions, they proclaimed that their rights as the sovereign people had been violated and referred to insurrection as their duty because they suffered under a tyrannical regime. As one leader put it, "Your so-called Republican government adopted the principle that sovereignty resides essentially in the people. Well, this sovereign people desires a king and the free exercise of their religion. This has always been their will, and you have despised it. They have all risen up to forcefully oppose tyranny." So, in many, if not most, retellings of the causes of the Vendean Revolt, a great emphasis is placed on the role of religion. This is a religious revolt, powered by the pious peasantry. But what if it wasn't? What if it was instead a peasant revolt with religious overtones? Some historians do not see religious tensions as the primary factor behind the insurrection. Instead, they emphasize the revolt's origins as a peasant revolt, and thus see social tensions as the primary cause for the rebellion. In particular, they see the civil war primarily through the prism of conflict between urban and rural communities. Historian Peter Kropotkin, for example, claims that the Vendée was a war declared by the villagers against the towns, especially against the middle classes of the towns. Picking up on this theme, other left-leaning scholars also emphasize the revolt's origins as a rural insurrection and point out that no major urban center declared in favor of the rebellion. Some of these urban centers were also deeply religious, and many had high proportions of non-juring clergy. And yet, they remained loyal to the Republic. If religion was the central factor in the revolt, why did these communities remain loyal to Paris? Historian George Lefebvre offers his own observations, which highlight social issues. Lefebvre notes that it was not the persecution of priests which triggered the uprisings. Instead, it was the issue of recruitment, a very worldly issue for a movement that some claim to be fueled by spiritual concerns. It wasn't priest hunts which triggered rebellion, but rather the quest for new soldiers in the army. Finally, other historians highlight additional evidence that the rebellion's origins were primarily social in nature. These historians demonstrate that many battle cries and propaganda slogans explicitly targeted the bourgeoisie of the towns. All of this has the hallmarks of a generic peasant insurrection against their social superiors in urban centres. Now, to be clear, what was happening here wasn't traditional class warfare. The rebels ultimately encompassed a whole cross-section of rural society. Peasants, nobles, gamekeepers, coach drivers, hell, even some non-constitutional priests joined the fray. They also included blacksmiths, millers, innkeepers, and other members of the countryside who didn't directly work the land. Against the rebels were urban workers, artisans, sailors, members of the bourgeoisie, and of course, the socially diverse armies of the Republic. So it's not that the divisions here are class-based, as much as it's urban v. rural. Hence, some historians place great emphasis on the Vendean uprising essentially as having its origins in a peasant revolt. Sure, it had religious overtones, but it's argued by some that these religious and royalist slogans were embraced later on to allow for a broader cross-section of the rural community to rally effectively under one banner. Now, just to be clear, I would say that the majority of historians place a far greater emphasis on the religious causes for the outbreak of the war. But what I find fascinating is that there are some historians across the ideological spectrum that support the importance of social tensions to varying degrees. For example, historian Alfred Cobbon was a groundbreaking revisionist historian of the 20th century, and he rejected much of the traditional conclusions of Marxist historians. However, on this issue, Cobbon does emphasize social conflict, stating point blank that the war basically represents peasant resistance to the domination of the towns. Writing a few decades later, the revisionist historian Simon Sharma doesn't go as far, warning that one shouldn't go searching for a coherent pattern of social issues that would explain a religious revolt in terms of something else. But he does concede that some rural communities perceived the town as exploiter and enemy, and this helped to shape the nature of the rebellion. Furthermore, historian Peter McPhee notes that some urban bourgeois communities in the region were firmly anti-clerical in nature. With the church owning so much land, it was bound to make enemies of someone, especially enterprising and ambitious landowners. This observation from McPhee offers a way to intertwine both social and religious tensions into just lots of tensions, as the anti-clericalism of some bourgeois communities provided ample reason for devout peasants to have a go at their godless and greedy landlords in the towns. So what's important here is that some historians place a great emphasis, at times the emphasis, on this urban-rural divide. For some, the origins of the Civil War are a genuine peasant revolt, which only subsequently becomes counter-revolutionary. Other historians disagree, choosing to highlight the religious causes of the insurrections, causes which mean the revolt was always counter-revolutionary in nature. Two separate conclusions, but both equally fascinating. So that's the first fault line. Historians cannot even agree on the very nature of this revolt. Unable to accept the origins of the insurrection, it's perhaps not surprising that the catalyst is also contentious. At the start of this episode, I informed you that numerous revolts broke out across Western France near simultaneously. Sounds suspicious, doesn't it? While most historians attribute the rebellion's outbreak to the arrival of army recruiters, not all agree. Instead of recruitment, they place the blame on conspiracy. Historian Peter Kropotkin, always one to identify a conspiracy, claims that the risings in the Vendée and Brittany were supported by a number of outside influences. The list of these foreign forces is considerable, including England, the émigrés on the Channel Island of Jersey, non-constitutional priests, and of course, their puppeteers in Rome. Kropotkin asserts that the risings had long been prepared, chiefly by priests, and thus the spontaneity of the revolt was not spontaneous at all. The French historian Jacques Gaudichet shares similar suspicions. For Gaudichet, the clues that the insurrection was premeditated are in the fact that some prominent nobles were in positions of leadership, seemingly from the revolt's commencement. describing the nobility as the revolt's most effective leaders, Godochet casts doubt on the claim that the army recruiters were the catalyst for widespread and near simultaneous insurrection. However, not everyone agrees. Other historians acknowledge the suspicious timing of the revolt, but don't go as far. Historian George Lefevre, one of the most respected Marxist historians, usually sings from a loosely similar hymn book to that of Kropotkin, although with a lot less razzmatazz. On this issue, however, Lefevre does not agree with Kropotkin one bit, nor does he share Godochet's perception of the initial role aristocrats played in the revolts. Instead, the respected historian states that while the uprisings would seem to have been coordinated, it's noteworthy that much of the countryside's nobility were caught off guard by the insurrections. In other words, it's unlikely that a conspiracy was driving the revolt if the eventual leaders of the rebellion weren't prepared for it. Historian Timothy Tackett, a revisionist historian writing much later than those we just heard from, draws similar conclusions. Tackett remarks the following on the revolt's origins, and note his belief of both the role of the nobility and the role of religion. The uprisings began everywhere at about the same time, in the second week of March, just as recruitment laws were beginning to be applied. Soon, panic-stricken reports were pouring into the convention from towns besieged by country people in Brittany, Normandy, Anjou, Maine, and Western Poitou. Numerous towns, including the great port cities of Brest and Nantes, were entirely cut off and lost all contact with Paris. Stunned deputies on mission in the Breton capital of Rennes reported that nearly the entire countryside is marching in battle formation, led by talented leaders. The ultimate cause of the massive uprisings in the West has been the subject of endless debate. It is clear that a certain number of local nobles and returning emigrants had been active in the area for over a year, hopeful of fomenting just such an uprising. Several of those who would soon lead the peasant armies in the region had been present in the Tuileries Palace, attempting to save the king on August 10. But in most cases, it was the country people themselves who took the initiative in recruiting nobles to lead them. Many of the peasants in question were sharecroppers whose rents had actually been raised by the revolution. The new tax laws allowed landowners to raise such rents, since they no longer had to pay the tithes and seigneurial dues, and the values of the rental property, they argued, had now increased. The central factor, however, uniting virtually all of the rebels in the West, was anger and indignation over the revolution's religious policies. So, some historians see recruitment as the catalyst for revolt, while others see conspiracy. This is the second key fault line relating to the origins and nature of the civil war in the Vendée. The fact of the matter is that almost nothing is agreed upon in relation to this civil war. Neither its catalyst nor its causes are without contention, and when we return to the Vendée, contention will remain. Most notably, some historians will label the events which unfold in the region as a genocide against French Catholics. But that is a controversy for another time. Having spent the last three episodes focused on events outside of Paris, you may be forgiven for thinking that the capital was quiet in comparison. In the space of just a few weeks, the military had attempted a coup, the enemy had returned, and civil war had erupted. Surely this was it. Surely the French nation could not endure yet another crisis. Be that as it may, the revolutionary cohorts of Paris had their own crisis to deal with, one of hunger. It's time to return to the capital, where empty stomachs and treasonous plots will fuel not just another insurrection, but the reign of terror itself. Thank you for listening to episode 55, Civil War in the Vendée. The episode extra for this episode is titled Hills, Hedges, and Humble Clerics. In it, we use a contemporary's memoirs to unpack why the topography of the Vendée was so beneficial to the defending insurrectionists. Furthermore, we also use those same memoirs to hear a royalist's perspective on the role of religion in the outbreak of the rebellion. As always, thank you so much to the patrons who support the show and keep Grey History on the air. If you're enjoying Grey History, if you want more Grey History, then help promote history that isn't black and white and join the community on Patreon today. There's hours of bonus content waiting for you right now, and certain tiers already have exclusive early access to episode 56, Fasting and Furious. If you're unable to support the show financially, there's other ways that you can help. If you could share Grey History with just one other person between now and the next episode, that would be amazing. If you hear someone mention a podcast, that's your time to shine. Another warm welcome to the newest patrons of the show, and a special call out to the exceptionally generous Heroes of the Revolution, Brian, Christy, Charles, Jeff, and Org. As always, thank you for listening, stay safe, and have a great day.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around, a watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom, and a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh, modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style, all for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast, free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.